I'm Emily Previty.
And I'm Stephanie Marudis. Welcome to Obscured from Kuvenda Media, the podcast about critical issues that don't get much attention because they're complex, overshadowed, and unfold largely out of the public eye.
As part of Banned Books Week, we're turning our attention to the right to intellectual freedom in prison and access to information for people who are incarcerated in America.
Over the last several years, you've probably noticed more and more coverage about book bans across the United States, but there's been relatively little attention paid to the right to read within prisons and jails, and perhaps even more so than before, as we're going to hear on this episode.
Stephanie looked into this issue previously, and in 2021, Kuvenda Media released Restricted Reading, a limited series based on her reporting. You can listen to the series on our website at kuvendamedia.com/restricted reading or wherever you listen to podcasts. But for now, let's turn it back over to Stephanie. She checked back with her sources to learn more about the latest efforts to expand library services for people who are incarcerated or detained.
Thanks, Emily. We're going to hear first from James Tager. He's the research director at PEN America and the author of a policy brief from 2019 called Literature Locked Up, How Prison Book Restriction Policies Constitute the Nation's Largest Book Ban. When I interviewed James for our Restricted Reading series, he shared a lot about the ins and outs of how prison censorship works. And I want to play you a short clip of what James shared with me in 2021 about how obscured prison censorship is from the public.
You cannot count on public outrage because the public can't be outraged by things that they don't see. And so many of these decisions don't reach sort of the light of day, whether it's because it's one individual mailroom officer making a decision for an individual incarcerated person, or because it just sort of never reaches journalists. So this is an issue that is largely undervisible or invisible to the average American. And this invisibility is really one of the greatest impediments to tackling this issue.
So that was 2 years ago. And when I recently caught up with James, I asked him whether his statement still holds true. Here's what he told me.
Yes, that statement is as true today as it was then, and perhaps more true. What we have noted over the past couple years is prisons and other carceral sites are continuing to roll out new restrictions on the right to read, state by state, system by system. It remains the case that many of these restrictions remain largely invisible to the larger public. They're rolled out as new regulations, new policies. They are rolled out to very little fanfare. Often it's either a policy that's rolled out within the prison or, you know, it's put up on a website and no one ever spells out, hey, this will have a massive effect on incarcerated people's right to read.
With the increasing number of book bans in schools, it made me wonder, how might that all affect prison censorship? But James couldn't say for sure.
I argued in 2019 that the system of book restrictions affecting America's incarcerated population represented the largest book ban in the United States. I still think that's true. When I said it, that was before the historic spike in book bans that we've seen in schools and libraries. You know, unfortunately, this doesn't mean that prison book banning has gotten better. It just means that other type of book bannings have gotten worse. I would say it's too early to speculate as to the ultimate effect that the moral hysteria galvanizing book banning in schools and libraries can have on prisons. We just don't know. But with that proviso, I'll speculate a little bit. It is possible that the increased sort of apparent societal acceptance of book banning in other areas may make it easier for carceral officials to get away with book banning in prisons. It is possible. It's also just as possible that it just will have no effect whatsoever.
James did go on to say that he and a team at PEN America are working on a major follow-up to the Literature Locked Up report as a way to help keep this issue visible.
The fact that banned books in schools and libraries have taken off at such an explosive rate means that this issue can lose some attention. My organization, PEN America, we're doing a lot on school and library book bans, and it is a problem that has exploded in terms of its severity. But we want to make sure that book bans for prisons doesn't fall by the wayside. And so this intended initiative is to do just that.
Over the past 2 years, there have been other major developments around the right to read in prisons and jails. For example, there's a bill in Congress right now called the Prison Libraries Act that would grant more money to prison libraries. James considers the proposed legislation to be historic, and I asked him to share his perspective about how it would work.
This is some low-hanging fruit, and I mean that as a compliment, not as a criticism. I mean, this is a really logical step to take in terms of expanding access to literature for incarcerated people, which is to increase funding for prison libraries. And one of the things that the act would do, and it's before Congress right now, is it incentivizes prisons to come up with good plans for how they're going to run their libraries. Prisons that are able to show that they have a good plan in place for how they're going to run their libraries, that they've thought it through, that they have a vision for what they want their library to achieve in terms of the rehabilitative benefits they want it to reap and in terms of access to literature they want it to offer. Those prisons get priority in terms of being approved for some of this potential funding. You know, overall, prison libraries in this country are, and I said this in my report, they are underfunded, under-resourced, understaffed, and understocked. They often get the short end of the stick when it comes to how prison administrators design their budgets. When it comes to budget cuts, they're often among the first in the chopping block. And they're unfortunately often completely inadequate to the needs of the population they're attempting to serve.
I also asked James what he thinks about the American Library Association's 2023 standards for library services for the incarcerated or the detained. They were last updated in 1992.
I'm waiting with bated breath for those to be rolled out. When they were developed, that was prior to what we've seen as a 30-year continuous increase in the incarcerated population. So we desperately need a new set of standards that sets the minimum guidelines for what we need from prison libraries in terms of their allocations, in terms of how many books per incarcerated person they should have. These are important standards. I, as an advocate for access to literature in incarcerated spaces, have relied on these standards in my own work. And so to have them updated is an overdue and very welcome step.
So as we've heard from James, there have been some major developments in this space over the last several years, but I did ask James whether he thought efforts to expand access could potentially backfire.
It's a very serious concern. The more you develop guidelines, for example, I've had a lot of conversations about, okay, how do we develop better guidelines that minimize the rationales for banning a book? I've had a lot of conversations with literature access advocates who have said, we'd prefer silence to sustain engagement on this specific case or this specific issue, because we're concerned that the more attention is paid, the more censors will look for new things to censor. That's a difficult balance to strike. It's something I think about a lot. It is one of the reasons why this is fraught work. It helps to illustrate why and how the biggest obstacle to access to literature is the censorship mentality. And you can have shiny new regulations that look good on paper. You can have old regulations that look bad on paper. And you can do a lot with changing the regulations themselves. But ultimately, we have to change the mentality of the censor who looks at these regulations with the desire to figure out how they can more effectively censor. And that's a bigger project than any one bill, than any one policy, than any one regulation, or than any one specific advocacy campaign for a specific book. But until we do that, prison book banning will remain a systemic issue.
Before we continue with our special Banned Books Week coverage about the right to read in prisons and jails, we wanted to let you know about another podcast that is exploring book restrictions across the United States.
At Brooklyn Public Library, we're launching a new podcast series called Borrowed and Banned to help you understand how and why books are being removed from library shelves across the country. and what you can do about it.
You don't ban Toni Morrison unless you are trying to prevent people understanding a very profound truth.
You know, it just brought me to a rage.
We're focusing on our education, but we're also out here fighting a fight that your generation was supposed to fight.
Subscribe to Borrowed and Banned wherever you find podcasts.
Let's get back now to the show. I also interviewed retired librarian Alden Ray James for our original Restricted Reading series. He goes by Ray and has been an advocate for prisoners' rights to read and access to information. Ray spent 70 months in federal prison, and that's when he decided to become a librarian. Since then, he's volunteered and served on various committees. Actually, he's part of the American Library Association's working group to draft the updated standards for library services for the incarcerated or detained, which we just talked about with James. I reached back out to Ray to discuss those standards, and we talked over Zoom. Our connection was a bit spotty, so you might hear that in the audio.
As a part of the project to rewrite the standards, I wrote forward and a preface. And one of the things that I wrote was, as people, we come to know ourselves and one another through access to information, including by sharing stories and our perceptions of the world. Sometimes by reading just the right book at just the right time, those of us with access to technologies and the internet likely base much of how we generally live our lives on that access. From entertainment to envisioning futures or reckoning with our past, our ability to find information and access books is a part of who we are. I wanted to share why these standards are important. Without having them, without enforcing them, then people will go wanting. They simply will find a dearth of information, and with that dearth, they will, like a flower, they will wither, and their mind will wither.
Ray told me that the updated standards are more inclusive and expansive to reflect a wider range of backgrounds among incarcerated or detained individuals. And finally, when I asked Ray for anything he would want listeners to know, he shared this story of what happened to him.
I remember an incident where I had more books than I was allowed to have. But I was allowed to have more books than anyone else because I was taking college courses. And eventually I just simply ran out of space in my locker. So I asked the boss, correctional officer, where I worked if I could store some books there. She said, sure, that's not a problem. So over a couple of weeks, I brought books there and stacked them up in a space that was unused and really didn't think any more about it. Then one night, the correctional officers had a search. They decided to search for contraband. And those books were not part of the facility requirements, so they were taken. They took my books, and they wouldn't let me have them back. No matter what, they said they don't know what happened to them. Is that censorship? In some way, yes, it is. It's certainly taking without recourse from an incarcerated person. That's one person in one facility. And there are so many stories of people who lose their writing because the correctional officer takes it. There are so many people who lose their will to live because they can't access what they need. There are people who try to follow the rules and are not successful. And they have their rights and their constitutional rights to access information taken away arbitrarily. The only way to change that is to promote the standards and promote their implementation, and to get the public in general involved in the process.
Next time on Obscured, we'll preview our special reported series, From Words to Weapons. It's about law enforcement trauma survivors who are often overlooked and how they go without the kind of support our systems offer to survivors of sexual assault, domestic violence, and other forms of trauma.
I think the biggest question for all of us, or at least for me, is, and it's an answer that will never come, and that is the why. One of the biggest things that could probably help is knowing that there's accountability for those who do wrong. That, for me, would be the biggest thing, just acknowledgement of the wrongdoing.
Obscured is produced by Kuvenda Media and mixed by Brad Linder. For more about our work, make sure to sign up for our newsletter at kuvendamedia.com and follow us on social at Kuvenda Media.
Special thanks to Obscured's fiscal sponsor, Media Alliance, which is one of the oldest media change organizations in the United States and helps our podcast receive tax-deductible contributions. And we're grateful to Obscured's founding supporters who've made donations to support our journalism initiative.
You can help more people discover Obscured by leaving us a review on your favorite podcast app and sharing it with others who might be interested. I'm Emily Previty, executive editor and co-creator of Obscured.
And I'm Stephanie Marudis, Kuvenda Media's executive producer and Obscured's co-creator. Thanks for listening.